Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles published in November of 2025 by the Geographic Society. So I hope you enjoy the program. We'll begin with this article, Scientists Put Sharks in a Tank Full of Toys. What they saw surprised them. It's by Gennaro Toma. Scientists have no problem using the word play to describe dogs who fetch sticks or cats batting around yarn. But with sharks, it's a whole other ballgame. A new study in the journal Applied Animal Behavioral Science describes sharks interacting with human toys in a way that resembles play, although the word play does not appear in the paper. Video footage from the study shows sharks swimming through hoops, picking them up with their nose, and flicking the toys with their tails, and bumping or biting them. Like they do in the wild, they would also rush toward one toy and then abruptly change direction last second. But does this amount to sharks playing? Study authors say that to claim that an interaction is play, the behavior needs to be contrasted with normal behavior, trigger a sense of reward in the brain of the animal, and happen when the animal is in a relaxed, unstressed context. Since the study didn't rigorously address those points, they understood why, according to them, journal reviewers told them to remove the word from their paper. Still, that doesn't mean sharks can't play. If you ask me casually, that's what we thought they were doing, says Patrick Sun, professor of ecology at Biola University and co-author of the study. We thought they were playing, and I think if we designed a more rigorous study, we would prove that they're playing. A tank full of toys. Virtually nothing is known about play behavior in sharks. In general, on a behavioral level, most research still centers on predation, and only recently have we begun to learn more about mating. But we still know very little about sharks' social behavior, communication, cognition, navigation, daily routines, and, of course, play, says Autumn Smith, a shark ecologist at Biola University in California and lead author of the study. To test the waters of potential shark play, Smith and her team conducted experiments at the Cabrillo Marine Aquarium in San Pedro, California. There, the team worked on a tank where 13 individuals from 4 different species coexist: horn sharks, swell sharks, leopard sharks, and a California skate. Once a week, when the sharks and the skate got feed, the researchers would go to the aquarium and fill the tank with toys, such as plastic squids, plastic rings, and thin, heavy tubes that sink to the bottom of the tank. They would do that 1 hour before the staff started feeding the fish. Then, when it was feeding time, they removed all the toys from the tank. 30 minutes after the sharks and the skate finished eating, they would put the toys back in. During both sessions, the team recorded the animals in the tank interacting with the toys. They kept doing this procedure once a week for 12 weeks during 2022. The observations revealed an unseen side of sharks. I was genuinely surprised how much interactions there were, says Smith. During the first sessions, the sharks and the skate didn't interact much with toys, but as time went by, they became more and more interested. Even within the species, there were personalities that started to develop, says Smith. Some individuals were more motivated to interact with the toys, while others showed less interest. Some even seemed to be possessive with a specific toy and hang on top or under it. Among all species, leopard sharks were the ones that interacted more with the toys. The sharks and the skate also interacted with toys more after feeding. This hints toward the idea that there is other motivations within them, a different cognitive basis that aren't hunger. Says Smith, that's something that we're trying to find out more about. Play or not play? That is the question. But are these sharks playing? Elisabetta Pelaghi, a comparative ethologist at the University of Pisa, who wasn't involved in the research, thinks it's hard to say whether what the sharks were doing can be defined as play or if it's an exploratory behavior. Pelaghi also points out that after some time, the shark motivation toward the toys seemed to decrease. She thinks this points more toward an exploratory behavior, where the sharks, after exploring the objects for some time and realize they don't provide food or anything else, lose interest in them. When you are dealing with species so different from us, whose behavior is often difficult to understand and is understudied, it is better to maintain a more cautious approach, says Pelaghi, adding that a longer observation might have revealed something more about the behavior. I wouldn't say necessarily that they have shown this as playing, but I do think it raises some interesting questions about, potentially, is that what's going on? Says Yanis Papastamatou, a predator ecologist at Florida International University, who wasn't involved in the study. I would say cautiously that there's a lot we don't understand about these animals. And that's the end of the article. The title was Scientists Put Sharks in a Tank Full of Toys. What They Saw Surprised Them, by Gennaro Toma. Our next article is titled, What's After You, Mommy? Scientists are hunting for the sixth basic taste. Could fatty or starchy one day become accepted as the sixth basic taste alongside the likes of sweet and salty? It's by Stacy Colino. In 1908, Japanese chemist Kakune Akeda was studying the active substances in kombu, or seaweed, when he made a discovery that would change food science forever. Akeda realized that a compound called glutamic acid was what gave seaweed such a distinct savory and meaty taste, nothing like the existing basic tastes of sweet, salty, sour, and bitter. He dubbed that taste umami. Yet even though people have been eating seaweed, mushrooms, miso, aged cheeses, and fermented foods for ages, it took nearly a century of scientific debate for umami to be recognized worldwide as the fifth basic taste. It wasn't until the 1990s that it gained universal recognition, and only after extensive psychophysical, electrophysiological, and biochemical studies that confirmed it was unlike any other existing taste. Is it time to add a sixth taste to the roster? Some scientists argue that the answer is yes. They have put forward several new contenders. Should it be fatty, starchy, kokumi, salty licorice? To varying degrees, researchers have made a case for all these in recent years. It isn't that scientists have been intentionally searching for a sixth taste. Rather, there's a fundamental science-based search for different ways we can experience the world in terms of taste and how it's detected, explains neuroscientist Emily Lyman, the Harold Dornseff Chair in neuroscience at the University of Southern California, who specializes in sensory biology. Breakthroughs in understanding the science of taste would allow food scientists to create more delicious foods and could also help doctors diagnose and treat related disorders that involve a loss of your sense of taste. But getting the scientific community to agree on a sixth taste is no easy feat. To qualify as a basic taste, any contender must be proven to be as distinct as the sweetness of berries or the bitterness of kale. What qualifies as a taste? First, it's important to note that there's a difference between taste and flavor, says Marissa Moore, an Atlanta-based registered dietitian in culinary nutrition. Taste begins on the tongue when the food molecules we eat mix with saliva and activate our taste buds, which then send signals to the brain and trigger the perception of distinct tastes. Contrary to popular belief, the tongue does not have specific areas that detect each type of taste. Instead, basic tastes can be picked up by taste buds on various parts of the tongue, though different cells may have varying levels of sensitivity to sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. While taste begins in the mouth, flavor is what registers in the brain when it combines the entire experience of taste, texture, temperature, and aroma. Taste and smell do interact in the brain to put together flavor, says Richard Matz, distinguished professor of nutrition science at Purdue University. But that's different from taste. The process of getting a new taste sensation accepted by the scientific community is complicated. There is no widely agreed upon set of 7 criteria, or if you tick each box, you've got it, Matz says. It's just scientific consensus. Even so, various criteria have been proposed over the years. For starters, a taste needs to have a chemical signature, a set of chemical stimuli that are distinct from that of other substances. Then, Matz says, you need to have a receptor anywhere on the tongue, palate, or throat where the chemical stimulus can interact with a cell in a taste bud. That cell in the taste bud must then have a mechanism to change the stimuli's chemical signal to an electrical signal that is subsequently transmitted through nerves to the brain, Matz adds. The electrical signal carried by taste nerves must activate regions in the brain that are associated with taste, and it needs to generate a unique taste perception in the brain that's independent from other tastes. If it can't overlap with another taste, Lim says. Finally, there needs to be a response in the body that results from these efforts. There should be a physiological response to activation of that sensory signal, Matz says. For example, he notes, the perception of sweetness triggers the release of insulin throughout the body. A major challenge is getting the scientific community to accept a new taste has to do with the complexity of the research that needs to be conducted. You have to go through a lot to prove a taste exists, says Don Jackson Blattner, a registered dietitian nutritionist in Chicago and recipe creator for national brands. The case for and against new tastes. None of the candidates for a sixth basic taste have passed this gauntlet of criteria yet, but some of them are closer to that benchmark than others. The unlikely. Scientists aren't quite convinced about kokumi a flavor-enhancing sensation naturally present in fermented foods, aged foods, and slow-cooked foods like stews. Discovered by Japanese scientists in the late 1980s, kukomi has been identified in an amino acid that interacts with the tongue's calcium receptors, which some argue make it a candidate as a taste. But kukomi is a bit idiosyncratic because it's as much a feeling or impression as a taste. Indeed, because kokumani is a savory sensation that enhances other flavors, rather than providing a distinct one on its own, it's not clear whether it's really taste or related to texture, says Ju-Yan Lim, a principal investigator at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. A lot of the taste world is problematic with words. Also in the murky area, salty licorice. In 2023, Lyman and her colleagues published a study in Nature Communications announcing they had found evidence that taste cells respond to ammonium chloride, which is used in tasty licorice, often present in Scandinavian candies, through the same protein receptor that signals sour taste. This research was touted and widely reported on as a potential sixth taste. But even Lyman wouldn't go as far as to describe it as a basic taste, and she points out that identifying a sixth taste wasn't the purpose of her research either. "We were trying to understand how ammonium chloride is detected," says Lyman. "It's a strong activator for the taste system and a common stimulus in the niche of taste research." She adds, "Our research raises the question of whether ammonium or sour is a fundamental taste, as both involve the same receptor and neither involves a single pure population of taste cells." Next is the possible. Then there's the middle ground of what might be accepted as a sixth taste, if more research can back it up. A small study published in the journal Chemical Senses in 2016 suggested that starchy qualifies as a basic taste because humans can identify the taste of starch without any sensorial clues, and saliva has enzymes that can break down starch. Every culture eats carbohydrates, often with every meal. It makes sense that we should be able to taste them, says Lim, a co-author of the study. While these criteria may have been proven, Lim's team is still looking for specific starch receptors in the mouth that would further support designated starchy as an official taste. Then there's the best bet. Only one recent candidate has come close to meeting the criteria for acceptance. In 2015, a team of researchers at Purdue University made a case for designating fat, as in fatty acids, as the sixth basic taste and proposed naming it Oleogustus. The moniker stems from the Latin words for fat, oleo, and taste, gustus. Unlike the pleasant mouthfeel many people associate with the taste of fat, oleogustus tastes like rancid oil, more like bitter than sweet or salty, says Matz. So far, most of the criteria have been met. The fat taste has been shown to stimulate taste receptors on the tongue, and it has a taste that's distinct from the other basic tastes. In addition, researchers have shown that specific receptors are activated by medium and long-chain fatty acids. And it's been shown that exposure to fat stimulates increases in blood concentrations of triacetylglycerols, a type of liquid that stores energy in the body. Yet, even when many of the criteria have been met with specific evidence, that doesn't mean something is automatically accepted as an official taste. The closer you get to changing long-held, deeply held views of how science works, the more resistance is encountered, Matz says. It takes a long time to get a scientific consensus. Why taste matters so much? Despite all these hurdles, scientists continue to study taste and debate what the next big one might be, because taste is important. For starters, it's about what we crave, how we cook, and how satisfied we feel after eating, says Blattner, author of The Superfood Swap. The basic tastes also can influence people's eating habits. For example, some researchers have linked an insensitivity to fatty acid tastes with overweight or obesity. On the other hand, research has found that sipping broth with a umami taste right before visiting a buffet can prevent people from gorging excessively. Specific tastes are also used to make meals satisfying, which can help us avoid overeating, Blattner says. The basic tastes play other roles, too. Some tastes have an evolutionary function. For bitter, it's often avoidance of plant toxins, Lyman notes. For sweet, it's for the caloric properties of carbohydrates. Indeed, some tastes can warn us not to eat foods that may be harmful, notes Blattner. It can help us figure out how fresh something is or whether something is spoiled. Matz's research, for example, found that Oleogustus isn't appealing. It's very unpleasant, he says. It's a warning signal, telling you this is not the best thing to eat. But the question of whether Oleogustus counts as a sixth taste is ultimately still a matter of debate. Perhaps we'll have an answer before the next century. And that completes the article. The title was What's After Umami? Scientists Are Hunting for the Sixth Basic Taste by Stacy Colino. This next article is titled Top Things to Know About the Day of the Dead by Logan Ward. Day of the Dead, or Dia de los Muertos, is not a Mexican version of Halloween. Though related, the two annual events differ greatly in traditions and tone. While Halloween embraces terror and mischief on the last night of October, Day of the Dead festivities unfold over the first 2 days of November in an explosion of color and life-affirming joy. Sure, the theme is death, but the point of Day of the Dead is to honor the dead by demonstrating love and respect for deceased family members. In towns and cities throughout Mexico, revelers don funky makeup and costumes, hold parades and parties, sing and dance, and make offerings to lost loved ones. Day of the Dead history goes back thousands of years. Day of the Dead originated several thousand years ago with the Aztec, Toltec, and other Nahuatl people, who considered mourning the dead disrespectful. For these pre-Hispanic cultures, death was a natural part of life, a continuum. The dead were still members of the community, kept alive in memory and spirit, and during Dia de los Muertos, they temporarily returned to earth. Today, Dia de los Muertos celebration is a mashup of pre-Hispanic religious rites and Christian feasts. It takes place on November 1st and 2nd, All Saints' Day, and All Souls' Day on the Catholic calendar, around the time of the fall corn harvest. It's been recognized by UNESCO. Cultural heritage is not just monuments and collections of objects. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, says that cultural heritage also includes living expressions of culture, traditions passed down from generation to generation. In 2008, UNESCO recognized the importance of Dia de los Muertos by adding the holiday to its list of intangible cultural heritage of humanity. Today, Mexicans from all religious and ethnic backgrounds celebrate the holiday, but at its core, Day of the Dead is a reaffirmation of indigenous life. Altars are important family traditions. The centerpiece of the celebration is an altar, or ofrenda, built in private homes and cemeteries. These aren't always altars for worshiping. Rather, they're meant to welcome spirits back to the realm of the living. As such, they're loaded with offerings, water to quench thirst after the long journey, food, family photos, and a candle for each dead relative. If one of the spirits is a child, you might find small toys on the altar. Marigolds are the main flowers used to decorate the altar. Scattered from altar to gravesite, the golden petals guide wandering souls back to their place of rest. The smoke from the copal incense, made from tree resin, transmits praise and prayers and purifies the area around the altar. Calaveras are key symbols. Calavera means skull, but during the late 18th and early 19th centuries, calavera was used to describe short, humorous poems, which are often sarcastic tombstone epitaphs published in newspapers that poked fun at the living. These literary calaveras eventually became a popular part of Dia de los Muertos celebrations. Today, the practice is alive and well. You'll find these clever, biting poems in print, read aloud, and broadcast on television and radio programs. And with that, we have run out of time. You've been listening to the National Geographic Society program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and thank you so much for spending your time with me today.